threw his wife an angry and astonished look as she rode away from him. Suddenly, he spurred his horse. Jesus, the ford and the river. It was impossible to cross there now. The earth had slid away recently. Slongbanbauga took longer strides when he noticed another horse chasing him. Erlan was deathly afraid. How she was racing down the steep slopes. He bounded past her through the copsewood and doubled back on the road where it flattened out for a short stretch to make her stop. When he came up alongside her, he saw that Kristen herself had grown a little scared. Erlund leaned over toward his wife and struck her a ringing blow beneath the ear. Slongvanbauga leaped sideways, startled, and reared up.
"Well, you deserved that," said Erlund, his voice shaking.
After the horses had calmed down and they once again rode side by side.
"The way you rushed off like that, senseless with fury. You frightened me."
Kristen held her hand to her head so that he couldn't see her face. Erlund wished that he hadn't hit her. But he repeated,
"Yes, you scared me, Kristen, to dash off like that. And to do so now," he said softly.
Kristen didn't reply. Nor did she look at him. But Erlan felt that she was less angry than before, when he had mocked her home. He was greatly surprised by this, but he saw that it was so. They arrived at Metalby, and Erlan's leaseholder came out and wanted to show them into the main house, but Erlan thought they first ought to inspect the buildings, and Kristen should come along.
"She owns the farm now, and she has a better understanding of such things than I do, Stein," he said with a laugh.
Several farmers were there, too, who were to act as witnesses, and some of them were also Erlund's tenants. Stein had come to the farm on the last turnover day, and since then he had been begging the master to come up and see the condition that the buildings were in when he took over, or to send an envoy in his stead. The farmers testified that not one building had been without leaks, and those that were now in a state of collapse had been that way when Stein arrived. Kristen saw that it was a good farm, but it had been poorly maintained. She saw that this Stein was a capable man, and Erlund was also very amenable and promised him some reductions in his land rent until he was able to repair the buildings. Then they went into the main house where the table was set with good food and strong ale. The leaseholder's wife asked Kristen's forgiveness for not coming out to greet her, but her husband would not allow her to step out under open sky until she had been to church after giving birth. Kristen greeted the woman kindly, and then she had to go over to the cradle to see the child. It was the couple's first, and it was a son, 12 nights old, big and strong. Then Erlund and Kristen were led to the high seat, and everyone sat down and ate and drank for a good long time. Kristen was the one who talked most during the meal. Erlund didn't say much, nor did the farmers, and yet Kristen noticed that they seemed to like her. Then the child woke up, at first whimpering, but then shrieking so terribly that the mother had to put him to her breast to calm his cries. Kristen glanced over at the two of them several times, and when the boy had had enough, she took him from the woman and held him in her arms.
"Look, husband," she said. "Don't you think he's a handsome and fine young fellow?"
"That he is," said Erlan,
not looking in her direction. Kristen sat and held the child for a while before she gave him back to his mother.
"I will send a gift over here to your son, Arndis," she said, "for he's the first child I've held in my arms since I came up here to the north."
Flushed and defiant, with a little smile, Kristen cast a glance at her husband and then at the farmers sitting along the bench. A few of them showed a slight twitch at the corner of the mouth, but then they stared straight ahead, their faces stiff and solemn. After a moment, a very old man stood up. He had been drinking heavily. Now he lifted the ladle out of the ale bowl, placed it on the table, and raised the large vessel.
"So let us drink to that, mistress, that the next child you hold in your arms will be the new master of Husaby."
Kristen stood up and accepted the heavy bowl. First, she offered it to her husband.
Erlon barely touched it with his lips, but Kristin took a long, deep drink.
Thank you for that greeting, Yawn of Skog, she said with a cheery nod, her eyes twinkling.
Then she sent the bowl around. Kristin could see that Erlon was red-faced and quite angry. She herself merely felt such a foolish urge to laugh and be merry. A short time later, Erlon wanted to leave, and so they set off on their way home. They had been riding for a while without speaking when Erlon suddenly burst out.
Do you think it's necessary to let even our tenants know that you were carrying a child when you were wed? You can wager your soul with the devil that talk about the two of us will soon be flying through all the villages along the fjord.
Kristin didn't reply at first. She stared into the distance over her horse's head, and she was now so white in the face that Erlon grew frightened.
I will never forget, for as long as I live, she said at last, without looking at him, that those were the first words you greeted him with, this son of yours that I carry under my belt.
Kristin, said Erlon, his voice pleading. My Kristin, he implored when she said nothing and refused to look at him. Kristin.
Sir?
She replied coldly and courteously, without turning her head. Erlon cursed so that sparks flew. He spurred his horse and raced ahead along the road. But a few minutes later, he came riding back toward her.
This time, I was almost so furious, he said, that I was going to ride away from you.
Kristin said calmly, Then you might have had to wait a good long time before I followed you to Husaby.
The things you say, said her husband, resigned.
Once again, they rode for some time without talking. In a while, they reached a place where a small path led up over a ridge. Erlon said to his wife,
I was thinking that we could ride home this way, over the heights. It will take a little longer, but I've wanted to travel up this way with you for some time.
Kristin nodded indifferently. After a while, Erlon said that now it would be better for them to walk. He tied their horses to a tree.
Gunnulf and I had a fortress up here on the ridge, he said. I'd like to see whether there's anything left of our castle.
He took Kristen's hand. She didn't resist, but walked with her eyes downcast, looking at where she set her feet. It wasn't long before they were up on the heights. Beyond the bare, frost-covered forest, in the crook of the little river, Husaby lay on the mountain slope directly across from them, looming big and grand with the stone church and all its massive buildings, surrounded by the broad acres and the dark forested ridge behind.
Mother used to come up here with us, said Erlon softly. Often. But she would always sit and stare off to the south, toward the Dovre range. I suppose she was always yearning, night and day, to be far away from Husaby. Or she would turn toward the north and gaze out at the gap in the slopes. There, where you can see blue in the distance. Those are the mountains on the other side of the fjord. Not once did she look at the farm.
Erlon's voice was tender and beseeching, but Kristin neither spoke nor looked at him. Then he went over and kicked at the frozen heath.
No, there's probably nothing left here of Gunnulf's and my fortress. And it was a long time ago, after all, that we played up here, Gunnulf and I.
He received no answer. Right below where they stood was a small frozen pond. Erlon picked up a stone and threw it. The hollow was frozen solid, so that only a tiny white star appeared on the black mirror. Erlon picked up another stone and threw it harder, then another and another. Now he was throwing them in utter fury, and in the end he would have splintered the ice with a vengeance. But then he caught sight of his wife's face. She stood there, her eyes dark with contempt, smiling scornfully at his childishness. Erlon spun around, but all at once Kristin grew deathly pale and her eyes fell shut. She stood there with her hands stretched out and groping, swaying as if she were about to faint. Then she grabbed hold of a tree trunk.
Kristin, what is it?
Erland asked in fear. She didn't answer, but stood as if she were listening to something. Her gaze was remote and strange. Now she felt it again. Deep within her womb, it felt as if a fish was flicking its tail. And again, the whole world seemed to reel around her, and she felt dizzy and weak, but not as much as the first time.
"What's the matter?" asked Erlan.
She had waited so long for this. She hardly dared to acknowledge the great fear in her soul. She could not speak of it. Not now, when they had been fighting all day long. Then he said it.
"Was it the child moving inside you?"
he asked gently, touching her shoulder. Then she cast off all her anger toward him, pressed herself against the father of her child, and hid her face on his chest. Some time later, they walked back down to the place where their horses were tied. The short day was almost over. Behind them in the southwest, the sun was sinking behind the treetops, red and dull in the frosty haze. Erland carefully tested the buckles and straps of the saddle before he lifted his wife up onto her horse. Then he went over and untied his own. He reached under his belt for the gloves he had put there, but he found only one. He looked around on the ground. Then Kristen couldn't resist and said,
"It will do you no good to look for your glove here, Erlan."
"You might have said something to me if you saw me lose it, no matter how angry you were with me," he replied.
They were the gloves that Kristen had sewn for him and given to him as one of his betrothal presents.
"It fell out of your belt when you hit me," said Kristen very quietly, her eyes downcast.
Erlan stood next to his horse with his hand on the saddle bow. He looked embarrassed and unhappy. But then he burst out laughing.
"Never would I have believed, Kristen. During all the time I was courting you, rushing around and begging my kinsmen to speak on my behalf and making myself so meek and pitiful in order to win you, that you could be such a witch."
Then Kristen laughed too. "No, then you probably would have given up long ago, and it certainly would have been in your own best interest." Erlan took a few steps toward her and placed his hand on her knee.
"Jesus help me, Kristen. Have you ever heard it said of me that I did anything that was in my own best interest?"
He pressed his face down in her lap and then looked up with sparkling eyes into his wife's face. Flushed and happy, Kristen bowed her head, trying to hide her smile and her eyes from Erlan. He grabbed hold of her horse's harness and let his own horse follow behind, and in this manner he escorted her until they reached the bottom of the ridge. Every time they looked at each other, he would laugh, and she would turn her face away to hide that she was laughing too.
"So," he said merrily as they came out onto the road again, "now we'll ride home to Husaby, my Kristen, and be as happy as two thieves."
Chapter 2. On Christmas Eve, the rain poured down and the wind blew hard. It was impossible to use sleighs, and so Kristen had to stay home when Erland and the servants rode off for the evening mass at Birksey Church. She stood in the doorway of the main house and watched them go. The pine torches they carried shone red against the dark old buildings, reflected in the icy surface of the courtyard. The wind seized the flames and flattened them out sideways. Kristen stood there as long as she could hear the faint sound of their passage in the night. Inside the hall, there were candles burning on the table. The remains of the evening meal were scattered about, lumps of porridge in dishes, half-eaten pieces of bread, and fish bones floating in puddles of spilt ale. The serving maids who were to stay at home had all fallen asleep on the straw spread out on the floor. Kristen was alone with them at the manor, along with an old man named On. He had served at Husaby since the time of Erland's grandfather. Now he lived in a little hut down by the lake, but he liked to come up to the farm in the daytime to putter around, in the belief that he was working very hard. On had fallen asleep at the table that evening, and Erland and Ulf had laughingly carried him over to a corner and spread a blanket over him. Back home at Urengard, the floor would now be thickly strewn with rushes, for the entire household would sleep together in the main house during the holiday nights. Before they left for church, they used to clear away the remains of the meal eaten after their fast, and Kristen's mother and the maids would set the table as beautifully as they could, with butter and cheeses, heaps of thin light bread, chunks of glistening bacon, and the thickest joints of cured mutton. The silver pitchers and horns of mead stood there gleaming, and her father himself would place the ale cask on the bench. Kristen turned her chair around to face the hearth. She didn't want to look at the loathsome table. One of the maids was snoring so loudly that it was awful to hear. That was also one of the things that she didn't care for about Erlon. At home on his estate, he ate in a manner that was so repugnant and slovenly, pawing through the dishes for good bits of food, hardly bothering to wash his hands before he came to the table. And he let the dogs jump up onto his lap and gulp down food along with him while everyone ate. So it was only to be expected that the servants had no table manners. Back home, she had been constrained to eat delicately and slowly. It would not be proper, said her mother, for the master's family to wait while the servants ate, and those who had toiled and labored should have time to eat their fill. Here, Gunnar, Kristen called softly to the big yellow bitch that lay with a whole cluster of pups against the draft stone by the hearth. She was such an ill-tempered animal, and that's why Erland had named her after the old mistress of Rovswold. You poor wretch, whispered Kristen, petting the dog who had come over and put her head on Kristen's knee. Her backbone was as sharp as a scythe, and her teats almost swept the floor. The pups were literally eating their mother up. Oh, yes, my poor wretch. Kristen leaned her head against the back of the chair and looked up at the soot-covered rafters. She was tired. No, she had not had an easy time of it these past few months that she had spent at Husaby. She had talked with Erland a little on the evening of the day they had gone to Medelby. Then she realized that he thought she was angry with him because he had brought this upon her.
I do remember, he said in a low voice, that day in the spring, when we went walking in the woods north of the church. I do remember that you asked me to leave you alone.
Kristen was pleased that he had told her this. Otherwise, she often wondered about all the things that Erland seemed to have forgotten. But then he said,
And yet, I would not have believed it of you, Kristen, that you could walk around bearing such a secret rancor toward me, and still act so gentle and happy. For you must have known long ago how things stood with you. And I believed that you were as bright and honest as the rays of the sun.
Oh, Erlon, she said sadly, you of all people in the world should know best that I have followed forbidden paths and acted falsely toward those who have trusted me most. But she wanted so much for him to understand. I don't know whether you recall, my dear, but in the past you have behaved toward me in a manner that some might not call proper. And God and the Virgin Mary know that I didn't bear you any grudge, nor did I love you any less. Erland's face grew tender.
So I thought, he said quietly. But you know too that I have striven all these years to rectify the harm I have done. I consoled myself that in the end I would be able to reward you, for you were so faithful and patient.
Then she said to him, No doubt you have heard about my grandfather's brother and the maiden Bengta, who fled from Sweden against the wishes of her kinsmen. God punished them by refusing to give the couple a child. Haven't you ever feared, during all these years, that he might punish us in that way too? She added, her voice quavering and soft, You can understand, my Erlon, that I was not very happy this summer when I first became aware of it. And yet I thought that if you should die before we were married, I would rather be left behind with your child than alone. I thought that if I should die in childbirth, it was still better than if you had no lawful son who could take your high seat after you, when you must leave this earth.
Erland replied vehemently,
Then I would think my son was too dearly bought if he should cost you your life. Don't talk like that, Kristen.
A little later, he said,
Husabi is not so dear to me. Especially since I realize that Orm can never inherit my ancestral property after me.
Do you care more for her son than for mine? Kristen then asked.
Your son?
Erlan gave a laugh.
Of him I know nothing more than that he will arrive half a year or so before he should. Orm I have loved for 12 years.
Sometime later, Kristen asked, Do you ever long for these children of yours?
Yes, said her husband. In the past, I often went over to see them in Ørsterdal, where they are living.
You could go there now, during Advent, said Kristen quietly.
You wouldn't be averse to it?
Asked Erland happily. Kristen said that she would find it reasonable. Then he asked whether she would be against it if he brought the children back home for Christmas.
You will have to see them sometime, after all.
And again she had replied that this too seemed reasonable to her. While Erland was away, Kristen worked hard to prepare for Christmas. It distressed her greatly to be living among these unfamiliar men and servant women now. She had to take a firm grip on herself whenever she dressed or undressed in the presence of the two maids, whom Erland had ordered to sleep with her in the hall. She had to remind herself that she would never have dared to sleep alone in the large house, where another had slept with Erland before her. The serving women on the estate were no better than could be expected. Those farmers who kept close watch over their daughters did not send them to serve on an estate where the master had lived openly with a concubine and had placed such a woman in charge. The maids were lazy and not in the habit of obeying their mistress. But some of them soon came to like the fact that Kristen was putting the house in good order and personally lent a hand with their work. They grew talkative and joyful when she listened to them and answered them gently and cheerfully. And each day, Kristen showed her house servants a kind and calm demeanor. She reprimanded no one, but if a maid refused her orders, then the mistress would act as if the girl did not understand what was asked of her and would quietly show her how the work was to be done. This was how Kristen had seen her father behave toward new servants who grumbled, and no man had tried twice to disobey Lavrans of Jorundgard. In this manner, they would have to make it through the winter. Later, she would see about getting rid of those women she disliked or could not bring around. There was one type of work that Kristen didn't dare take up unless she was free from the eyes of these strangers. But in the morning, when she was alone in the hall, she would sew the clothing for her child. Swaddling clothes of soft homespun, ribbons of red and green fabric from town, and white linen for the christening garments. As she sat there with her sewing, her thoughts would tumble between fear and then faith in the holy friends of humankind, to whom she had prayed for intercession. It was true that the child lived and moved inside her so that she had no peace night or day. But she had heard about children who were born with a pelt where they should have had a face, with their heads turned around backwards, or their toes where their heels should have been. And she pictured Svein, who was purple over half his face because his mother had inadvertently looked at a fire. Then Kristen would cast aside her sewing and go over to kneel before the image of the Virgin Mary and say 7 Ave Marias. Brother Edvin had said that the Mother of God felt an equal joy every time she heard the angel's greeting, even if it came from the lips of the most wretched sinner. And it was the words Dominus Tecum that most cheered Mary's heart. That was why Kristen always said them 3 times. This always helped her for a while. She knew of many people, both men and women, who paid scant honor to God or to his mother, and who kept the commandments poorly. But she hadn't seen that they gave birth to misshapen children because of it. Often God was so merciful that he did not visit the sins of the parents upon their poor children, although every once in a while he had to show people a sign that he could not perpetually tolerate their evil. But surely it would not be her child. Then she called in her heart upon Saint Olaf, He was the one she had heard so much about that it was as though she had known him while he lived in Norway and had seen him here on this earth. He was not tall, quite stout, but straight-backed and fair, with a gold crown and shining halo on his golden curls, and a curly red beard on his firm, weather-beaten, and intrepid face. But his deep-set and blazing eyes looked straight through everyone. Those who had strayed did not dare look into them. Kristen didn't dare either. She lowered her gaze before his eyes, but she was not afraid. It was more as if she were a child and had to lower her eyes before her father's glance when she had done something wrong. Saint Olav looked at her sternly but not harshly. She had promised to better her life after all. She longed so fervently to go to Nidaros and kneel down before his shrine. Erland had promised her this when they came north, that they would go there very soon. But the journey had been postponed. And now Kristen realized that he was reluctant to travel with her. He was ashamed and afraid of gossip. One evening when she was sitting at the table with her servants, one of the maids, a young girl who helped in the house, said,
"I was wondering, mistress, whether it wouldn't be better if we started sewing swaddling clothes and infant garments before we set up the loom that you're talking about."
Kristen pretended not to hear and kept on talking about wool dyeing. Then the girl continued,
"But perhaps you have brought such garments from home?"
Kristen smiled faintly and then turned back to the others. When she glanced at the maid a little while later, she was sitting there bright red in the face and peering anxiously at her mistress. Kristen smiled again and spoke to Ulf across the table. Then the young girl began to weep. Kristen laughed a bit, and the maid cried harder and harder until she was sniffing and snuffling.
"Stop that now, Frida," Kristen finally said calmly. "You hired on here as a grown-up serving maid. You shouldn't behave as if you were a little child."
The maid whimpered. She hadn't meant to be impertinent, and Kristen mustn't be angry.
"No," said Kristen, smiling again. "Eat your food now and stop crying. The rest of us have no more sense either than what God has granted us."
Frida jumped up and ran out, sobbing loudly. Later, when Ulf Haldorsson stood talking to Kristen about the work that had to be done the next day, he laughed and said,
"Erland should have married you 10 years ago, Kristen. Then his affairs would have been in a better state today, in every respect."
"Do you think so?" she asked, smiling as before. "Back then, I was 9 winters old. Do you think Erland would have been capable of waiting for a child bride for years on end?"
Ulf laughed and went out. But at night, Kristen would lie in bed and weep with loneliness and humiliation. Then Erland came home during the week before Christmas, and Orm, his son, rode at his father's side. Kristen felt a stab in her heart when Erland led the boy forward and told him to greet his stepmother.
He was the most handsome child. This was how she had thought he would look, the son that she carried. Sometimes, when she dared to be happy, to believe that her child would be born healthy and well-formed, and to think ahead about the boy who would grow up at her knee, then it was like this she pictured him. Just like his father. Orm was perhaps a little small for his age, and slight, but handsomely built, with fine limbs and a lovely face, his complexion and hair dark, but with big blue eyes and a soft red mouth. He greeted his stepmother courteously, but his expression was hard and cold. Kristen had not had the chance to talk with the boy further. But she sensed his eyes on her, wherever she walked or stood, and she felt as if her body and gait grew even more heavy and clumsy when she knew the boy was staring at her. She didn't notice Erland talking much with his son, but she realized that it was the boy who held back. Kristen told her husband that Orm was handsome and looked intelligent. Erland had not brought his daughter along. He thought Margaret was too young to make the long journey in the winter. She was even more lovely than her brother, he said proudly when Kristen asked about the little maiden, and much more clever. She had her foster parents wrapped around her little finger. She had wavy golden hair and brown eyes. Then she must look much like her mother, thought Kristen. And she couldn't help the feeling of envy that burned inside her. She wondered where Erland loved his daughter the way her father had loved her. His voice had sounded so tender and warm when he spoke of Margaret. Kristen stood up and went over to the main door. It was so dark and heavy with rain outside that there seemed to be no moon or stars. But she thought it must soon be midnight. She picked up a lantern from the entryway, went inside, and lit it. Then she threw on her cloak and went out into the rain.
"In Christ's name," she whispered,
crossing herself three times as she stepped out into the night. At the upper end of the courtyard stood the priest's house. It was empty now. Ever since Erland had been released from the ban of excommunication, there had not been a private cleric at Husaby. Now and then one of the assistant priests from Orkadal would come over to say Mass, but the new priest who had been assigned to the church was abroad with Master Gunulf. They were apparently friends from school. They had been expected home this past summer, but now Erland thought they wouldn't return until after spring. Gunulf had had a lung ailment in his youth, so he would be unlikely to travel during the winter. Kristen let herself into the cold, deserted house and found the key to the church. Then she paused for a moment. It was very slippery, pitch dark, windy and rainy. It was reckless of her to go out at night, and especially on Christmas Eve, when all the evil spirits were in the air. But she refused to give up. She had to go to the church.
"In the name of God, the Almighty, I here proceed," she whispered aloud.
Lighting her way with a lantern, Kristen set her feet down where stones and tufts of grass stuck up from the icy ground. In the darkness, the path to the church seemed exceedingly long, but at last she stood on the stone threshold in front of the door. Inside, it was piercingly cold, much colder than out in the rain. Kristen walked forward toward the chancel and knelt down before the crucifix, which she glimpsed in the darkness above her. After she had said her prayers and stood up, she stopped for a moment. She seemed to expect something to happen to her, but nothing did. She was freezing and scared in the desolate, dark church. She crept up toward the altar and shone her light on the paintings. They were old, ugly, and stern. The altar was bare stone. She knew that the cloths, books, and vessels lay locked up in a chest. In the nave, a bench stood against the wall. Kristen went over and sat down, placing the lantern on the floor. Her cloak was wet, and her feet were wet and cold. She tried to pull one leg up underneath her, but the position was uncomfortable. So she wrapped the cloak tightly around her and struggled to focus her thoughts on the fact that now it was once again the holy midnight hour when Christ was born to the Virgin Mary in Bethlehem.
Verbum caro factum est, et habitavit in nobis.
Kristen remembered Sira Eirik's deep, pure voice, and Audun, the old deacon, who never attained a higher position, and their church back home where she had stood at her mother's side and listened to the Christmas Mass. Every single year she had heard it. She tried to recall more of the holy words, but she could only think about their church and all the familiar faces. In front, on the men's side, stood her father, staring with remote eyes into the dazzling glow of candles from the choir. It was so incomprehensible that their church was no more. It had burned to the ground. She burst into tears at the thought. And here she was, sitting alone in the dark on this night when all Christian people were gathered in happiness and joy in God's house. But perhaps that was as it should be, that tonight she was shut out from the celebration of the birth of God's Son to a pure and innocent maiden. Her parents were no doubt at Sundbu this Christmas. But there would be no Mass in the chapel tonight. She knew that on Christmas Eve those who lived at Sundbu always attended the service at the main church in Ladam. This was the first time, for as far back as Kristen could remember, that she was not at the Christmas Mass.
She must have been quite young the first time her parents took her along. She could recall that she was bundled up in a fur-lined sack, and her father had carried her in his arms. It was a terribly cold night, and they were riding through a forest. The pine torches shone on fir trees heavy with snow. Her father's face was dark red, and the fur border on his hood was chalk white with frost. Now and then he would bend forward and nip the end of her nose and ask her whether she could feel it. Then, laughing, he would shout over his shoulder to her mother that Kristen's nose hadn't frozen off yet. That must have been while they were still living at Skog. She couldn't have been more than 3 winters old. Her parents were quite young back then. Now she remembered her mother's voice on that night, clear and happy and full of laughter, when she called out to her husband and asked about the child. Yes, her mother's voice had been young and fresh. Bethlehem. In Norwegian, it means the place of bread. For that was where the bread which will nourish us for eternal life was given to the people. It was at the Mass on Christmas Day that Sira Eirik stepped forward to the pulpit and explained the Gospels in the language of his own country. In between the Masses, everyone would sit in the banquet hall north of the church. They had brought ale with them and passed it around. The men slipped out to the stables to see to the horses. But on vigil nights, in the summertime before a holy day, the congregation would gather on the church green, and then the young people would dance among the servants. And the Blessed Virgin Mary wrapped her son in swaddling clothes. She placed him in the straw of the manger, from which the oxen and asses ate. Kristen pressed her hands against her sides. "Little son, my own sweet child, my own son. God will have mercy on us for the sake of his own blessed mother. Blessed Mary, you who are the clear star of the sea, the crimson dawn of eternal life, who gave birth to the son of the whole world. Help us. Little child, what is it tonight? You're so restless. Can you feel beneath my heart that I am so bitterly cold?" It was on the Children's Day last year, the fourth day of Christmas, when Sira Eirik preached about the innocent children whom the cruel soldiers had slaughtered in their mother's arms. But God had chosen these young boys to enter into the hall of heaven before all other blood witnesses. And it would be a sign that such belonged to the kingdom of heaven. And Jesus picked up a little boy and put him among them. "Unless you create yourselves in their image, you cannot enter into the hall of heaven, dear brothers and sisters. So let this be a solace to every man and woman who mourns a young child's death." Then Kristen had seen her father's eyes meet her mother's across the church, and she withdrew her gaze, because she knew that this was not meant for her. That was last year, the first Christmas after Ulvild's death. "Oh, but not my child. Jesus Maria, let me keep my son." Her father had not wanted to ride in the races on St. Stefan's Day last year, but the men begged him until he finally agreed. The course extended from the church hill at home down to the confluence of the two rivers near Loptsgard. That's where they joined up with the men from Otadal. She remembered her father racing past on his golden stallion. He stood up in his stirrups and bent low over the horse's neck, shouting and urging the animal on, with the whole group thundering behind. But last year he had come home early, and he was completely sober. Normally on that day the men would return home late, tremendously drunk, because they had to ride into every farm courtyard and drink from the bowls brought out to them, to honor Christ and Saint Stefan, who first saw the star in the east as he drove King Herod's foals to the River Jordan for water. Even the horses were given ale on that day, for they were supposed to be wild and reckless. On St. Stefan's Day, the farmers were allowed to race their horses until vespers. It was impossible to make the men think or talk of anything but horses. Kristen could remember one Christmas when they held the great drinking feast at Uhringard. And her father had promised a priest who was among the guests that he would be given a young red stallion, son of Guldsvein, if he could manage to swing himself up onto the animal as it ran around unsaddled in the courtyard. That was a long time ago, before the misfortune with Ulvild occurred. Her mother was standing in the doorway with the little sister in her arms, and Kristen was holding on to her dress, a bit scared. The priest ran after the horse and grabbed the halter, leaping so that his ankle-length surcoat swirled around him, and then he let go of the wild, rearing beast. "Foal, foal! Whoa, foal! Whoa, son!" he cried out. He hopped and he danced like a billy goat. Her father and an old farmer stood with their arms around each other's necks, the features of their faces completely dissolved in laughter and drunkenness. Either the priest must have won Rowden, or else Lavrans gave the foal to him all the same, for Kristen remembered that he rode away from Urengard on the horse. By that time they were all sober enough. Lavrans respectfully held the stirrup for him, and the priest blessed them with three fingers in farewell. He was apparently a cleric of high standing. Oh, yes. It was often quite merry at home during the Christmas season. And then there were the Christmas masqueraders. Kristen's father would sling her up onto his back, his tunic icy and his hair wet. To clear their heads before they went to Vespers, the men threw ice water over each other down by the well. They laughed when the women voiced their disapproval of this. Kristen's father would take her small, cold hands and press them against his forehead, which was still red and burning hot. This was out in the courtyard in the evening. A new white crescent moon hung over the mountain ridge in the watery green air. Once, when he stepped into the main house with her, Kristen hit her head on the doorframe, so she had a big bump on her forehead. Later, she sat on his lap at the table. He lay the blade of his dagger against her bruise, fed her tidbits of food, and let her drink mead from his goblet. Then she wasn't afraid of the masqueraders who stormed into the room.
"Oh, father. Oh, father. My dear, kind father."
Sobbing loudly, Kristen now hid her face in her hands. Oh, if only her father knew how she felt on this Christmas Eve. When she walked back across the courtyard, she saw that sparks were rising up from the cookhouse roof. The maids had set about preparing food for the churchgoers. It was gloomy in the hall. The candles on the table had burned out, and the fire in the hearth was barely smoldering. Kristen put more wood on and blew at the embers. Then she noticed that Orm was sitting in her chair. He stood up as soon as his stepmother saw him.
"My dear," said Kristen, "didn't you go with your father and the others to Mass?"
Orm swallowed hard a couple of times.
"I guess he forgot to wake me. Father told me to lie down for a while in the bed on the south wall. He said he would wake me." "That's too bad, Orm," said Kristen.
The boy didn't reply. After a moment, he said,
"I thought you went with them after all. I woke up and was alone here in the hall."
"I went over to the church for a little while," said Kristen.
"Do you dare to go out on Christmas Eve?"
asked the boy.
"Don't you know that the spirits of the dead could come and seize you?"
"I don't think it's only the evil spirits that are out tonight," she said. "Christmas Eve must be for all spirits. I once knew a monk who is now dead and standing before God, I think, because he was pure goodness. He told me, 'Have you ever heard about the animals in the stable and how they talk to each other on Christmas Eve? They could speak Latin back then. And the rooster crowed, Christus natus est.' No, now I can't remember the whole thing. The other animals asked, 'Where?' And the goat bleated, 'Bethlehem, Bethlehem.' And the sheep said, 'Eamus, Eamus.'"
Orm smiled scornfully.
"Do you think I'm such a child that you can comfort me with tales? You should offer to take me on your lap and put me to your breast."
"I told the story mostly to comfort myself, Orm," said Kristen quietly. "I would have liked to go to Mass too."
Now she couldn't stand to look at the littered table any longer. She went over, swept all the scraps into a trencher, and set it on the floor for the dog. Then she found the whisk made of sedge under the bench and scrubbed off the tabletop.
Would you come with me over to the Western storehouse, Orm? To get bread and salted meat. Then we'll set the table for the holy day, said Kristen.
Why don't you let your maidservants do that? Asked the boy.
This is the way I was taught by my father and mother, replied the young mistress, that at Christmas time, no one should ever ask anyone else for anything. But we should all strive to do our utmost. Whoever serves the others most during the holidays is the most blessed.
But you're asking me, said Orm.
That's a different matter. You're the son here on the estate. Orm carried the lantern, and they walked across the courtyard together. Inside the storehouse, Kristen filled two trenchers with Christmas food. She also took a bundle of large tallow candles. While they were working, the boy said,
That must be a peasant custom, what you mentioned a moment ago. For I've heard he's nothing more than a homespun farmer, Lavrans Björgolfsson.
Who did you hear that from? Asked Kristen.
From mother, said Orm. I heard her say it all the time to father when we were living here at Husaby before. She said he could see that not even a gray-clad farmer would give his daughter's hand in marriage to him.
It must have been pleasant here at Husaby back then, said Kristen curtly.
The boy didn't reply. His lips quivered.
Kristen and Orm carried the filled trenchers back to the hall, and she set the table. But she had to go back over to the storehouse for food once again. Orm took the trencher and said, a little awkwardly,
I'll go over there for you, Kristen. It's so slippery in the courtyard.
She stood outside the door and waited until he returned. Then they sat down near the hearth, Kristen in the armchair and the boy on a three-legged stool nearby. After a moment, Orm Erlandsson said softly,
Tell me another story while we sit here, my stepmother.
A story? Asked Kristen, her voice equally quiet.
Yes, a tale or some such that would be suitable on Christmas Eve, said the boy shyly.
Kristen leaned back in her chair and wrapped her thin hands around the animal heads on the armrests.
That monk I mentioned, he had also been to England, and he said there is a region where wild rose bushes grow that bloom with white blossoms on Christmas night. Saint Joseph of Arimathea put ashore in that area when he was fleeing from the heathens, and there he stuck his staff into the ground, and it took root and flowered. He was the first to bring the Christian faith to Bretland. The name of the region is Glastonbury. Now I remember. Brother Edwin had seen the bushes himself. King Arthur, whom you've no doubt heard stories of, was buried there in Glastonbury with his queen. He was one of the seven most noble defenders of Christendom. They say in England that Christ's cross was made of alderwood. But we burned ash during Christmas at home, for it was the ash tree that Saint Joseph, the stepfather of Christ, used when he needed to light a fire for the Virgin Mary and the newborn Son of God. That's something else that Father heard from Brother Edwin.
But very few ash trees grow up north here, said Orm. They used them all up for spear poles in the olden days, you know. I don't think there are any ash trees here on Husaby's land, other than the one standing east of the manor gate, and Father can't chop that one down, because the spirit of the first owner lives underneath. But you know, Kristen, they have the Holy Cross in Romaborg, so they must be able to find out whether it was made of alderwood.
Well, said Kristen, I don't know whether it's true. For you know, it's said that the cross was made from a shoot of the tree of life, which Seth was allowed to take from the Garden of Eden and bring home to Adam before he died.
Yes, said Orm. But then tell me.
Sometime later, Kristen said to the boy, Now you should lie down for a while, kinsman, and sleep. It will be a long time yet before the churchgoers return.
Orm stood up. We have not yet toasted each other as kinsmen. Kristen Lavrans' daughter.
He went over and took a drinking horn from the table, drank to his stepmother, and handed her the vessel. She felt as if ice water were running down her back. She couldn't help remembering that time when Orm's mother wanted to drink with her, and the child inside her womb began to thrash violently.
What's going on with him tonight?
wondered the mother. It seemed as if her unborn son felt everything that she felt, was cold when she was cold, and shrank in fear when she was frightened. But then I mustn't be so weak, thought Kristen. She took the horn and drank with her stepson. When she handed it back to Orm, she gently stroked his dark hair. No, I'm certainly not going to be a harsh stepmother to you, she thought. You handsome, handsome son of Erlan. She had fallen asleep in her chair when Erlan came home and tossed his frozen mittens onto the table.
Are you back already? Said Kristen, astonished. I thought you would stay for the daytime mass.
Oh, two masses will last me for a long time, said Erland as Kristen picked up his icy cape. Yes, the sky is clear now, so the frost has set in.
It was a shame that you forgot to wake Orm, said his wife.
Was he sad about it? Asked Erland. I didn't actually forget, he went on in a low voice. But he was sleeping so soundly, and I thought, you can well believe that people stared enough because I came to church without you. I didn't want to step forward with the boy at my side on top of that.
Kristen said nothing, but she felt distressed. She didn't think Erland had handled this very well. Chapter 3 They did not have many guests at Husaby that Christmas. Erlan didn't want to travel to any of the places where he was invited. He stayed home on his manor and was in a bad humor. As it turned out, he took this act of fate more to his heart than his wife could know. He had boasted so much of his betrothed ever since his kinsmen had won Lavran's assent at Urengard. This was the last thing Erlan had wanted, for anyone to believe that he considered her or her kinsmen to be lesser than his own people. No, everyone must know that he held it to be an honor and a distinction when Lavrans Björgulfsson betrothed him to his daughter. Now people would say that Erland had not considered the maiden much more than a peasant child, since he had dared to offend her father in such a manner by sleeping with the daughter before she had been given to him in marriage. At his wedding, Erland had urged his wife's parents to come to Husaby in the summer to see how things were on his estate. He wanted to show them that it was not to paltry circumstances that he had brought their daughter. But he had also looked forward to traveling around and being seen in the company of these gracious and dignified in-laws. He realized that Lavrans and Ronfrid could hold their own among the most esteemed of people, wherever they might go. And ever since the time when he was at Urengard and the church burned down, Erland had thought that Lavrans was rather fond of him, in spite of everything. Now it was unlikely that the reunion between Erland and his wife's kinsmen would be pleasant for either party. It angered Kristen that Erland so often took his ill temper out on Orm. The boy had no children of his own age to play with, so he was frequently peevish and in the way. He also got into a good deal of mischief. One day, he took his father's French crossbow without permission, and something broke in the lock. Erlan was very angry. He struck Orm on the ear and swore that the boy would not be allowed to touch a bow again at Husaby. It wasn't Orm's fault, said Kristen without turning around. She was sitting with her back to the two, sewing. The spring was bent when he took it, and he tried to straighten it out. You can't be so unreasonable to refuse to allow this big son of yours to use a single bow out of all those you have on the estate. Why don't you give him one of the bows from up in the armory?
You can give him a bow yourself, if you feel like it, said Erlan furiously.
I'll do that, replied Kristen in the same tone as before. I'll speak to Ulf about it the next time he goes to town.
You must go over and thank your kind stepmother, Orm, said Erland, his voice derisive and angry.
Orm obeyed, and then he fled out the door as fast as he could. Erland stood there for a moment.
You did that mostly to annoy me, Kristen, he said.
Yes, I know I'm a witch. You've said that before, replied his wife.
Do you also remember, my sweet, said Erland sadly, that I didn't mean it seriously that time?
Kristen neither answered nor looked up from her sewing. Then Erland left, and afterwards she sat there and cried. She was fond of Orm, and she thought Erland was often unreasonable toward his son. But the fact was that her husband's taciturn and aggrieved demeanor now tormented her so that she would lie in bed and weep half the night. And then she would walk around with an aching head the next day. Her hands had become so gaunt that she had to slip several small silver rings from her childhood days onto her fingers after her betrothal and wedding rings to keep them from falling off while she slept. On the Sunday before Lent, late in the afternoon, Sir Baud Peterson arrived unexpectedly at Husaby with his daughter, a widow, and Sir Munon Baudson and his wife. Erland and Kristen went out to the courtyard to bid the guests welcome. As soon as Sir Munon caught sight of Kristen, he slapped Erland on the shoulder. "I see that you've known how to treat your wife, kinsman, so that she is thriving on your estate. You're not so thin and miserable now as you were at your wedding, Kristen. And you have a much healthier color, too," he laughed, for Kristen had turned as red as a rosehip. Erland did not reply. Sir Baud wore a dark expression, but the two women seemed neither to hear nor see a thing. They greeted their hosts formally and with courtesy. Kristen had ale and mead brought over to the hearth while they waited for the food. Munon Baudson talked without stopping. He had letters for Erland from the Duchess. She was inquiring what had become of him and his bride, whether he was now married to the same maiden that he had wanted to carry off to Sweden. It was hellish traveling now, in midwinter, up through the valleys and by ship to Nidaros. But he was on the king's business, so it would do no good to grumble. He had stopped by to see his mother at Haugen, and he brought them greetings from her. "Were you at Urengard?" Kristen ventured. "No," for he had heard that they had gone to a wake at Blakarsarv. A terrible event had occurred. The mistress, Tora, Ronfrid's kinswoman, had fallen from the storeroom gallery and had broken her back, and it was her husband who had inadvertently pushed her out. It was one of those old storerooms without a proper gallery. There were merely several floorboards placed on top of the posts at the second-story level. They had been forced to tie up Rolf and keep watch over him night and day ever since the accident occurred. He wanted to lay hands on himself. Everyone sat in silence, shivering. Kristen didn't know these kinsmen well, but they had come to her wedding. She felt suddenly strange and weak. Everything went black before her eyes. Munon was sitting across from her and he leaped to his feet. When he stood over her, his arm around her shoulder, he looked so kind. Kristen realized that it was perhaps not so odd for Erland to be fond of this cousin of his. "I knew Rolf when we were young," he said. "People felt sorry for Tora, Guttrum's daughter. They said he was wild and hard-hearted. But now you can see that he cared for her. Oh yes, many a man may boast and pretend that he'd like to be rid of his spouse, but most men know full well that a wife is the worst thing they can lose." Baud Pettersson stood up abruptly and went over to the bench against the wall. "May God curse my tongue," said Sir Munon in a low voice. "I can never remember to keep my mouth shut either." Kristen didn't know what he meant. The dizziness was gone now, but she had such an unpleasant feeling. They all seemed so peculiar. She was glad when the servants brought in the food. Munon looked at the table and rubbed his hands. "I didn't think we'd be disappointed if we came to visit you, Kristen, before we have to gnaw on Lenten food. How have you managed to put together such delicious platters in such a short time? One would almost think you had learned to conjure from your mother. But I can see that you're quick to set forth everything a wife should offer to please her husband." They sat down at the table. Velvet cushions had been placed for the guests on the inner benches on either side of the high seat. The servants sat on the outer bench, with Ulf Haldorsson in the middle, right across from Erland. Kristen chatted quietly with the women guests and tried to conceal how ill at ease she felt. Every once in a while, Munon Baudson would interrupt with words that were meant to tease, and it was always about how Kristen was already moving so slowly. She pretended not to hear. Munon was an unusually stout man.
His small, shapely ears were set deep in the ruddy, fat flesh above his neck, and his belly got in his way when he sat down at the table. "Yes, I've often wondered about the resurrection of the body," he said, "whether I'm going to rise up with all this